That was a little bit of Joe McPhee's Nation Time from the album of the same name, originally released in 1970. Joe McPhee is not my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, but I might never have heard Nation Time if it wasn't for the man I am talking to. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to episode 37 of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is a part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which is partnered with Jambase, a website for the live music community. Visit the OSIRIS page on jambase.com to check out all the other shows they offer. There's almost 30 of them at this point on all kinds of subjects, so I'm positive you'll find something else that interests you. And if you'd like to support Burning Ambulance, you can do that by going to patreon.com/burningambulance and signing up as a subscriber for just $5 a month. Subscribers get monthly Spotify playlists curated by me, as well as the occasional piece of exclusive content. And the more people sign up, the better the perks and the website and this podcast will all get, so please do consider becoming a member. My guest this episode is John Corbett. He's a musician, a music critic, a former professor, a record producer. He books shows, he runs an art gallery, he basically does everything you can and must do if you're going to make a living on the cultural fringes. His latest book, which is the reason for this interview, is called Pick Up the Pieces, Excursions in 70s Music. And it's a semi-autobiographical journey through all sorts of records released between 1970 and 1980. It's a really interesting book, and he's a great writer with a really unique approach to something that could have just been an encyclopedia of classic rock lore. So I definitely recommend that you check it out. It's available now from the University of Chicago Press. We talk about the book in this interview, but we also talk about a lot of other things as well. I first noticed John Corbett's name almost 20 years ago when he reissued Joe McPhee's Nation Time as the first CD in the Unheard Music series, a string of close to 70 albums, some reissues and some never-before-released material, by free and avant-garde jazz artists, European free improvisers, and people who didn't fit into any category at all, or who were their own category, like Peter Breutzmann and Sun Ra. The Unheard Music series was incredibly important in the early 2000s because it brought this music to the attention of a whole generation of younger listeners, and perhaps just as importantly, a whole generation of critics who wound up writing for Pitchfork, Spin, Stereo Gum, and a lot of other places. Without drawing a whole lot of attention to himself, always keeping the focus on the music, John Corbett did an incredible job of spreading the word about this kind of obscure music. And he's continued doing that with his most recent project, Corbett vs. Dempsey, which is an art gallery, a small publishing house, and a record label. He's picking up where the Unheard Music series left off, reissuing some incredible records, among them drummer Milford Graves' Bobby, a self-released album from the early 1970s that's like a holy grail for free jazz fans. Original vinyl copies cost hundreds of dollars, and Corbett vs. Dempsey has put it out on CD with a bonus disc of never-before-heard music from 1969 by the same trio. I'm going to play a short piece from Bobby now, and after that you're going to hear my conversation with John Corbett.
You know what? I mean, since you just sort of came off the road and you're promoting the book, you know, Pick Up the Pieces, Excursions in 70s Music, before we start the, you know, sort of interview proper, like, do you want to give a condensed version of your spiel as though you were, you know, at a book event, like do the song and dance?
Sure. We could integrate that into the interview if you want to do it that way. I'm perfectly fine.
Like, for someone who doesn't know you, what is the deal with the book?
Okay. Yeah. Well, so Pick Up the Pieces, Excursions in 70s Music is a book of 78 essays, short essays, not all in the same modality, but they move basically concentrating on one or two records per chapter, arranged chronologically by year, from 1970 to 1980. And there are 4 to 10 records per year, with the exception of 1980. And it's looking at basically the what happened to the music industry at that point, what happened to music across that period, the amazing flourishing of many different kinds of musics, and the cross-pollination between different musics, and seeing it not from an academic standpoint, not really from an outside standpoint, but largely from the standpoint of a young person coming to it. So there's some memoir-like aspects of much of it, stories from my young life. And then looking at that music from now, and in some cases coming to it fresh much later, not having known about it. So Gal Costa, for instance, the great Brazilian singer, is somebody I didn't know until the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is a matter of kind of moving back and forth between all sorts of different music as it becomes important to me, and in some cases after the fact, having become something that I've discarded, or something that is no longer useful, or that's become useful again after having been left on the shelf for a long time.
Yeah. I found that mix really interesting, the mix of artists discussed in the book, because my first impulse, as someone who's read your writing for, 20 years, my first impulse was to count the jazz records. And mm-hmm. I found about a half dozen alongside, you know, mainstream rock and punk and R&B stuff, when in my head I mostly associate you with weird, you know, more with weird jazz stuff than with, say, yep. Aerosmith, as much as I love yep. 70s Aerosmith. I mean,
yep.
you want to talk about a band that was just wrecked by getting sober. It was Aerosmith.
True.
You
Good
know.
Point, yeah.
But,
yeah.
But I mean, what was your criteria for inclusion?
Well, I worked building the checklist of what would be in and what wouldn't be in was a long process, and in some cases it had to do with writing chapters and then discarding them. And it was intuitive as much as anything. But I knew that to go to the point that you're making about my such that it is public persona as someone who's been an advocate for more obscure music and someone who's written critically about more obscure music, starting with jazz as a more obscure music and then moving into much more obscure territory from that. That was one of the things that I went into wanting to write the book thinking about. I'd been aware, especially in the last 5 or 10 years, that I've been revisiting some things. So I'd gone back and listened to the remastered Fleetwood Mac records, you know, the reformed Fleetwood Mac from the mid-70s, that were so important to me when I was a kid. And I'd listened to them with the ears of someone who had spent 35 years carefully listening to and writing about all sorts of other music that in some ways I'd always thought was much more sophisticated and much more nuanced. And then going back and realizing part of the reason I love that music is that it's sophisticated and it's nuanced and it's really exceptional music in a way that I didn't understand at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, that there are things that I thought were wonderful that now listening with those same ears that have been tuned by, let's say, Derek Bailey, and listening to, you know, Sonny Rollins, and listening to an understanding all sorts of things that people like Ted Nugent, whatever you think about him as a public person, that the music doesn't hold up the same, and that listening back to those records now I understand why they are lesser. in a musical way.
Mm-hmm.
So it, that was an interesting, and so when I found myself going back and doing some reassessment and listening back to a lot of, like, Aerosmith is a great example. I was listening to Rocks and Toys in the Attic a lot and thinking it would be an interesting challenge to try to find my own way to write about this music. It's not writing that's about the trivia of that music. That has been done up and down. Their drug habits, their who they were sleeping with, what, you know, what guitar amps they were using, that kind of stuff. You know, there are several magazines dedicated to the unearthing of all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I was much more interested in trying to find my own way of writing about it that had something to do with the sense and sensibility of someone who would be listening to that music then and now. And so that's where it comes from. And I guess the last point I'll make about it is that I felt a little disingenuous. If anyone would think that I was listening to this, let's say, unpopular music, thinking that I was better than the popular music that I also was listening to, I felt that that would be a poor representation of my actual taste.
Mm-hmm.
And that I, you know, that the admission that this is music that's of great interest and sustained interest and great importance to me was something I wanted to kind of try my hand at.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely get that, because I am very much in the same position. As much as I love, you know, out jazz and all sorts of, you know, jazz and obscure music and stuff like that, I still listen to Ted Nugent, you know. I still listen to a ton of Aerosmith. I listen to, you know, Montrose, you know, and all this, like, early 70s hard rock. I love that stuff, you know. But
yeah.
And so that leads me to a sort of a side point, which is, was there a different criterion for the jazz and improv selections in the book? Because they seem relatively obscure compared to the rock and punk stuff, even when you take into account the obscurity of jazz as a whole versus rock. Like, I mean, there's no Miles Davis, there's none of the big 70s fusion acts or anything like that, and there's also very little prog, which surprised me. I kind of figured you might be a Yes guy.
There's a Yes chapter.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, those are all, you know, the whole book is, it's, as I say early on, it's my 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing about my 70s, and I have to admit, you know, 70s Miles wasn't of great interest to me until much later.
Uh-huh.
I was interested in Miles's earlier music. 60s music. If I was writing about that, about Miles's electric music, I think I would have been writing about the late 60s more than the 70s, although I love some of the 70s electric music as well now. But I don't know, that wasn't important to me in the same way as Sly was, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to say, what I would have wanted to say about that music, I felt like I wanted to say about Sly and Family Stone and Parliament. And it was an opportunity as well for me to try to implicitly explain why I was interested in that, relatively, even within the pantheon, relatively obscure music that I am interested in, that I do hold so dear, how I could be listening to, you know, Yes, and at the same time listening to, or more or less the same time, listening to Derek Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
And then finding it fascinating that Derek Bailey interviewed Steve Howe, although he was kind of ruthlessly mean to him in his book. I see what you're saying, but, like, to me, those people, like, Julius Hempel, he's right dead in the middle of the canon for me. You know, he's not an obscure figure. Joe McPhee, I wanted to write about because I think he should be right in the middle of the pantheon. And he's somebody that I worked with for many, many years. And so there are personal connections with some of the people I was writing about from the jazz and improvised music world that I wanted to pay attention to and homage to. And yeah, I don't know, 70s jazz, straight ahead 70s jazz was not so important to me and maybe isn't as important to me. I do believe, and I say, I mean, in the Julius Hempel chapter, you know, I kind of take issue with the basic notion that 70s jazz is a lost cause, which has been made many times in many different contexts, and I think is total bullshit.
It really is. I have been digging deep into stuff. Actually, this is something I was going to ask you about later, because I have this idea that's been bubbling in my head that where 70s jazz is concerned, the critics have won, in the sense that, for example, Anthony Braxton's Arista Records, which I love, or Dogon AD, are seen as more important to the music's history now than what Joe Henderson or McCoy Tyner or Sonny Rollins were doing in the 70s. And to me, there's like a real story of 70s jazz in CTI and Muse and Milestone and the music they were putting out, as much as there is to the loft scene. But I almost feel like in the last decade or so, there's been a critical overcorrection in the direction of Hempel and Braxton and, you know, all that sort of avant stuff. And the stuff that actually, that won critics' polls and that was popular at the time, as popular as jazz was in the 70s, is kind of forgotten.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I see it. I mean, it depends on who, amongst whom is it forgotten. There's still, that's music that's still very dear to a lot of jazz heads. I mean, there, you know, you'll see, I mean, I think if you, you know, in Downbeat, for instance, you'll see a lot more attention paid to those folks in the 70s even than you'll see now paid to, you know, let's say Braxton's a special case because he's always been controversial for, you know, for people, and I think he continues to be somebody that's very hard to fit into any kind of a canon.
Yeah.
Deliberately so. But I mean, I take your point, and I think you're right. There's probably a I'm not sure I think the overcorrection, because I think that the things that remain the most dear to me, and that are the things that are, I would argue, the pushing forward of the jazz continuum, are the things that I think you're saying still have, or have now come around, the correction itself. The things that are being forgotten that you're talking about, let's say the great Elvin Jones Jazz Machine Records, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have there's a lot of love out there for them, even if they're might not be the same critical apparatus supporting them. But I mean, all of this is so marginal.
Yeah.
The amount of attention that gets paid to any of it, we're talking about really, you know, the fact that a few people have written a few books that emphasize, you know, Braxton over Joe Henderson. I don't know. That, I don't think that's a massive overcorrection. If Joe Henderson was in any danger of being forgotten, that would be a travesty. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. It's just, it seems weird to me. Like, I did two series of posts on Burning Ambulance, the website. One where for a week I wrote five posts about the 20 albums that McCoy Tyner recorded between 1970 and 1979. And then later I did another week of posts where I did all of Joe Henderson's albums from 63 to 81, you know, where there's about 20 records. And I mean, I got, you know, comments. People were saying, wow, I've never even heard of this album. And, you know, like, this stuff is great. And I'm like, yeah, this stuff is amazing. You know, McCoy's band from like 1975 was earth shaking, you know?
Yeah.
But then it's like, you know, it kind of gets swept away by, you know, the inevitable tide of history, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I see the more advantageous strategy in looking at that to unite the, let's say, outcats and the worthy mainstream rather than pitting them against one another, because I think that you know, that sense of an overcorrection, you know, Braxton was around in the 60s and was making recordings in the 60s and it was being ferociously denigrated in the period that he was being, you know, he was coming up. So there was I don't know, it's just I think the big problem is that unlike, you know, that there are too few people like you who can see it in its entirety and can understand its the sweep of it, and that these things need to be considered next to one another.
Right.
Instead, people want to kind of cut it all off and say this ought to be considered not next to that. And I see those records that you're talking about as being the cousins of the great records that Blue Note was making that are the ones that get also forgotten from the 60s, like the Andrew Hill records, mm-hmm. like the Sam Rivers records, like those, the records that are a little more out there, that are where the orchestrations are really daring, where the, you know, and they're not hard bop records, and they're, so they made, and the Cecil Taylor records on Blue Note.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's the continuum, those kind of really rich, really interesting, larger ensemble records that people like McCoy Tyner were making. They weren't coasting. They were making really interesting, they were approaching arrangement in a really interesting way. And that's part of the same continuum with somebody like Braxton. It's just approaching it from a different way. So I see it as part of the same thing. No, I didn't include that in this book. Maybe in part just because it was not as much my world. But that's a good correction. I mean, that would be, you know, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the thing that first put it in my head was a year or two ago, I read a book that was, the title was literally Jazz in the 70s. You know, mm-hmm. It's a recent book, and I'm blanking on the author's name right now. But it really, really focused on the Braxton and beyond side of things to...
It was Bill Shoemaker's book.
Bill Shoemaker's book, exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I felt like it was really unbalanced in that way. And I'm like, there is no countervailing narrative here right now, because, you know, nobody's out there saying, well, what about all the stuff that people actually liked back then, you know, that sort of thing. But
yeah.
But getting back to the early 70s, I'm kind of fascinated by that era anyway, because I feel like, and I have long felt and have, you know, made this argument with classic rock people who get really mad, that the music made between 1970 and 1975 is much more interesting than the music being made between 1964 and 1969.
Mm.
Like, it seemed like there were a lot more ideas at work, and the boundaries between jazz and rock and other forms of music were a lot more porous. I mean, one of the big examples that I always think of is, it's not really hard to hear Santana's album Lotus, the live album from Japan, and yep. Miles Davis's Agartha as very much like kindred spirits.
Sure.
And then you throw Mahavishnu and King Crimson and early Stanley Clarke and Funkadelic in there, and it's like the whole world is exploding, you know. But then in half of the 70s, like post 76, I feel like things settle down a lot and get kind of reactionary, which I would say includes punk. I mean, is that your impression as well?
Definitely not. Absolutely not. No, I would totally disagree with that. No, I agree with your point about the, you know, I think we, all of these eras have their exceptionalist aspects. So, and when you start trying to categorize them in terms of their superiority in one form or another, in one way or another, I think I understand that that's a parlor game and it's fun to play. I think, you know, there are reasons that the 70s were so rich in that respect, and part of the reason is what opened up before it in the late 60s. Late 60s was a pretty amazing period all around too. This is the problem with having, you know, decade markers, is that they seem like they mark something real, and they don't usually mark anything real. There's usually a continuum, and there's all sorts of interesting tributaries that run from one place in one decade into another place. And another, you know, the 60s, late 60s is often seen, or mid to late 60s is often seen as this period of great cross-fertilization. I think the 70s is really that period. And I think the late 70s is when I got interested in, I mean, that's when I really became a record collector. It's when I became dedicated. I think punk is one thing. Punk is what, a year, really? Mm-hmm. Year and a half? Post-punk is what I think a lot of people mean when they say punk, and post-punk is really interesting and is at least as fertile for me in terms of the things that I'm interested in and music that I've followed and the ideas that I've gotten out of it, at least as fertile as a lot of the stuff that was going on in the early 70s, some of which, you know, there's plenty of music in that period if we're looking at the whole cross section of music generally. A lot of stuff in that period too that's a kind of less interesting holdover from the 60s. So, you know, one hand giveth, the other hand taketh away.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, post-punk, you know, really offers us some incredible music starting in 1970, late 77, with the Buzzcocks' first single, which is sort of signals the beginning of this DIY period.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I have another semi-annoying theory, which I'm going to run past you, because yep. I have this theory that first wave punk, particularly the sort of the New York CBGB's class and the London class as well, was kind of art school students and their writer friends entertaining each other. Mm-hmm. And good ideas emerged from it, but it was basically a little community making music for itself. And in the early 80s, after all the rhetoric about, you know, punk was anybody can do it, blah, 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 it sort of filtered out into the hinterlands in America and filtered out into the grubby Midwestern suburbs, and everybody started doing it. And that's when you got hardcore, which the first class of music critics that had embraced punk because it was them and their buddies vehemently rejected all of that. And I always found hardcore, as dumb as it was, with the exception of like two or three bands, to be much truer to the kind of proletarian vernacular rhetoric that was attached to first wave punk.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I see it that way. I think the I mean, this may also just say, hey, John Corbett's not somebody who filters things so much through the question of whether they're popular or not, or what their audience is or not. I mean, of course, I'm interested in that from a sociological standpoint, but in terms of their value, or in terms of the truth quotient of their desire to be proletarian, I mean, there, if we're going back into politics, there are all sorts of different approaches to the idea of being, of being effective counter agents to, capitalism. And that idea of proletarianism appealing to the broadest set of masses, that's not always the way that worked. But the point for me is, when I think about, like, let's say New York punk in the mid 70s, I mean, I agree that it's coming out of a fairly rarefied group, but I don't know. I mean, there are all sorts of other people who came to it. It was not music that was attempting to draw a mass audience. I mean, it was pretty noisy, pretty aggressive, pretty abrasive. So it wasn't exactly saying, "Hey, come out, get into me." It was making its audiences do that on its own terms. And you can't, I mean, I think then to compare that with what's going on 15 years later, well, you already have 15 years of myth making about that earlier movement at work in what's going on in those garages across America. And I agree. I mean, I do agree that there's a kind of categorical difference in terms of who's making it and how people are consuming it.
Yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, okay, the Ramones is 76, 77, but Black Flag formed in 78 in their most embryonic form. And so by 1980, 81, when they're emerging, there's already this sense of, ugh, we didn't invite you to our party. You know, like they were bringing in this crowd of, thick-necked goons with them, in a sense. And so.
Yeah, but I mean, it was still small audiences. It was, they weren't playing stadiums. The audience might be a little bit different in makeup, but, there were thick-necked goons in London for various of the first wave British punk. Punk's always been split between a kind of a more intellectual lineage and a more, let's say, populist lineage. And so the play back and forth between those, the gray zone between them, and then the qualities that each of them has, I mean, that's a something. And even in American context, I think in the first wave there were bands that were, not quite as intellectually oriented. I mean, the Ramones, even though, that's a good example. I mean, they were interested in a whole bunch of things. They were not they weren't writers. They weren't coming out of an intellectual milieu. They were doing something else. And the New York Dolls are another good example of that. The New York Dolls were bringing a whole different group of people in. And the question of, how people of different backgrounds came into those settings was really played out very differently in all those different cases. I mean, I see what you're saying for sure, but I wouldn't want to overstate how successful, like, hardcore was at really being proletarian, because I think, yes, they, Minor Threat lived out its its ethics, you know. But the audiences weren't necessarily that much more massive. They were just really different. I mean, I've been dealing with, you know, jazz and improvised music and small press poetry for a long time, so you've got to be willing to deal with small audiences.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about some of your other projects, because
sure.
I feel like I first noticed your name on the Unheard Music series, which was, for those listening to this who don't know, was a series of about 60 or 70 CDs that were either reissues of long out of print albums or in some cases previously unreleased material, all coming from the sort of free jazz and European improv with a capital I zones. So how did that series get its start?
Well, it got its start in about 1998 or 9. I'd been already kind of involved for a long, long time, I guess since the mid 80s, in freely improvised music. And I started hearing in writing about it and in presenting concerts of improvised music. And I started hearing rumors through the mill from musicians and from various writers and other places that in Europe, these amazing repositories of jazz and improvised music that had accumulated at radio stations where they had made you know, great radio recordings over the years were being discarded because they take up a lot of space and they were seen as being without value. So I was curious whether that was actually happening. So I actually got a grant from the Goethe Institute to go over and do a little survey of that. And I went across Germany and lo and behold, that was beginning to happen. People were starting to think about trying to downsize, and they weren't necessarily thinking, as I would, that what they ought to do is transfer all of that material to some digital storage medium. They were just throwing them out. So I made it my business to go through at the places that I went to, which was maybe 5 or 6 stations across the country, just made lists of things that were of particular interest to me and asked for copies of them and started working on beginning to think about why this material was not available and what would it mean to start to put some of it out there. And then at the same time, I was thinking about all of the records that were out there that I wanted to hear that I couldn't hear because they weren't reissued, or records that I loved that I had a copy of that I couldn't share with people because they weren't publicly available. And so that sort of set of interests conjoined when I sat down with Kurt Kellison, who ran Atavistic Records, and proposed the idea of having a sub-label on his label called the Unheard Music Series, taking its name from a song by the Los Angeles punk band X.
Mm-hmm.
And began to license some of that music from the radio stations, began to approach people, many of whom I knew, some whom I didn't know, and reissue their music. And so we put together over the course of 10 years, as you say, about 65 or 70 records, a book, and a handful of DVDs of material that had been either long out of print or never in print. And I think we told a little kind of created an alternate history in the process, opened up another history that's now being very thoroughly explored in various places very effectively, I think. You know, so Honest John's has put out a whole series of Derek Bailey reissues, which is great to see because of all ludicrous things, Derek Bailey's music was getting hard to find. So if you're talking to some young person, they're sitting there telling you they've never heard of Derek Bailey, and you can't really say, well, go get this record.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's sort of where it came from. And then, you know, around 2004, I opened an art gallery with my business partner, Jim Dempsey. And we pulled that activity over to the of the Unheard Music series over to our, sort of made it in-house at Corbett versus Dempsey, where it now resides.
Yeah, yeah. When you started out, how many of these titles that you did eventually release did you know you want, did you have on your, you know, wish list, or were, and then as it went on, did you discover more stuff? Did people come to you saying, oh, you've got to do this one record, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was all of that. I mean, I had some things that I knew I thought were ludicrous that they hadn't been reissued. The first two that we issued were Peter Brotzman's great record Nipples and Joe McPhee's legendary record Nation Time.
Mm-hmm.
I knew for sure I wanted to do Nation Time. And Nipples felt to me like a lost classic. And lo and behold, both of them, I mean, we couldn't have started with a better pair right out of the gate. And there was just, at that moment, there wasn't anybody doing any of that, really. Not much in the way of that. Certainly not in an American context doing anything with the European stuff. And Joe was largely neglected, aside from Hat Hut, and Hat Hut had, before that, had sort of not been dealing with him as much because they had a lot of other things on their plate.
Mm-hmm.
So those were great, but then as we went along, trusted friends like Mats Gustafsson would introduce me to records that ought to be back out there again, and I would sometimes, like for instance, we put out some Scandinavian free jazz records that I had never heard of, by people I'd never heard of before, like the Mount Everest Trio. And that's one of my favorite records that we put out, or later we put out a record by a super interesting guitar player named Stefan Harda, who's, you know, as obscure as anyone can get, but who really had his own way of doing things, really special, special feel. And so those are things that came directly from Mats. And so there was a kind of a range of things that I discovered, things I knew I already wanted to do, and things that people turned me on to.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even within that music, which is, you know, niche to begin with, as we've been discussing, like, you must have known that some of these titles weren't going to do as well as, say, a Brotzman record or a Sun Ra record.
Yeah.
So what did you work to strike a balance in that way?
I did, and I was upfront with just sort of about which records I thought would sell well and which ones I thought might not. But we had amazing distribution. You know, that was a period, it's not now, but that was a period where we were being distributed through a rock distributor, and that had amazing advantages in terms of putting those records in front of the you know, buying public that interested in the same kind of sensibility but from a rock perspective. And so, you know, it got it out there into the bloodstream. You know, the death of Touch and Go as a distributor was a big loss for us in a lot of ways. And when that happened, that was the beginning of what would later we would realize was an enormous shift in the industry. So, you know, we still do CDs. I'm very committed to putting this music out on CD because I think it's a good way to share it, and I do think it makes it relatively affordable. But we sell, a third of what we would have sold back then.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's just the reality of it. I mean, we sold in the 10,000 copies of Nipples, which is a lot of records. For that kind of music, that's a lot of records. That's nothing. I mean, that's an embarrassment in mainstream music. But in this world, that's a lot of copies.
Yeah, yeah. Was there one unheard music title that you really wanted to be better received than it was? And on the flip side, was there something that did much better than you had hoped? Aside from sort of the series as a whole doing better than you had hoped, you know?
No, I think we did really well. I mean, I was very satisfied with the way that everything worked. I mean, I think we contributed to the broadening of the knowledge about that music and bringing things out that would then be reissued later, and that's happened quite a bit, actually. So, something that I'm trying to think about a record that I wished had gotten more acknowledgement. Yeah, I think we put out fairly early on. We put out a solo record by Sven-Åke Johansson called Schlingerland.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things with rock distribution is that sometimes those records would go out into the world and then they wouldn't actually sell, and then you'd get a lot of returns. And that record sold fairly well into stores, but then didn't sell from stores as well. And that's a record that, it's an incredible solo drum record. I wish more people knew about it. But it didn't sell very well.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, because you brought up the idea that the series as a whole, and it did this for me. I'll say that up front. It did this for me. It brought an awareness of this music to a whole bunch of people who would maybe never have discovered it on their own. And a lot of those people were, a generation of young music critics, I feel like. You know, people who wound up writing for Pitchfork and Spin and, places like that. And so I'm wondering what you think about the impact that it had on people's understanding of the music. Because I feel like, between you and, to a certain degree, Thurston Moore and a few other people, Byron Coley, there was this kind of gradual injection into the discourse, in quotes, of a mindset, that, to put it in the most shorthand form, there are people who consider themselves jazz fans who know way more about Sun Ra than they do about Duke Ellington, without necessarily realizing that Sun Ra's entire career is like a conversation with Duke Ellington.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you, what do you think about that kind of thing? I mean, everybody's knowledge is limited, but, it's...
Well, I agree with you completely, and maybe this brings me back to the point that you were making about the CTI stuff and some of that, because I think actually it's a good point what you were saying about that I've always, we in the Unheard Music series, we put out a lot of different kinds of things. For instance, we put out Baby Dodds's solo drum record. And I wanted to draw, that was always Han Benninck's favorite record. And it had been out of print and unavailable for a very, very long time. It turned out you could get it as a special order from the Smithsonian Folkways.
Wow.
I didn't know that at the time, but then I called them up and I talked to them about it, and I licensed it from them and I put it out myself. But that's not a record that you think of as a great avant-garde jazz record, so to speak. And I didn't care. I mean, I was interested in trying to draw those people across those supposed battle lines. I think people who listen exclusively to, the most whatever avant I have a lot of trouble with that term avant, but the avant jazz, and don't understand any of the connections that it has to other kinds of jazz, to the jazz that it came out of, to the jazz that it related to. I'm interested in trying to draw those lines. So we put out a Barney Willen record on the Unheard Music series, and it did extremely well because it was a record that was made right at the same time that Willen was playing with Miles Davis, and it's a beautiful record, and it was totally unavailable before we put it out. I'm interested in sometimes confounding those supposed dichotomies or those supposed border lines, and confounding them just by putting things out into the world so that people can listen to them. So, for instance, I think I would take your point about McCoy Tyner more than your point about Miles Davis, because writing about Miles Davis in Pick Up the Pieces would have seemed to me almost too on the nose, where writing about McCoy Tyner would have been a really good idea, because it would have drawn attention to the fact that there were these commonalities, not just because this is a, you know, great and well-known musician, but because of the things that were going on in that music that would have been that should be interesting to anybody who's listening to Sun Ra, who I did write about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's interesting, you know, like I was interested across the board. I'm interested in sort of challenging my own preconceptions and my own interests and orientations where I can, and seeing whether, you know, sometimes you challenge those and then you come back and you say, no, they were right. And sometimes you come back and you say, yeah, I've got to rethink that. And I have to try to understand the bigger picture from a better vantage.
Yeah. So I want to ask specifically regarding, because first, as you said, you know, he was one of the earliest artists in the Unheard Music series, and now with Corbett versus Dempsey, you have done a lot of work with Joe McPhee over the years, reissuing a bunch of his early records and releasing new music as well. So he's clearly a major figure in your jazz cosmology. Why is that? What draws you to his music?
Well, I started working on Joe and with Joe quite early in my career, in the mid-1980s. And I think it came from being drawn to a sense of humanity that I got out of his music that I felt quite special to him, and not necessarily, you know, exclusive to him, but was something that I heard that really touched me. And I'm talking about records like Tenor, which was maybe the first record that of his that I got that really just stirred me that way, and then a record called Olio, which is a quartet record with French musicians. And I heard in his music a kind of bridge to a bridge between things that I was beginning to get interested in about European improvised music and things about the American post-free jazz scene. And he was very approachable also. I got to know Joe in 1985. I interviewed him, spent time with him, went to see him whenever I could. And we developed a long-term friendship. And from there, it just grew. And my admiration for him and my understanding of what he was doing, he's a very humble person, but he's a very decisive person. And he knows what he likes and he knows what he wants to do. And I learned an enormous amount from listening to him. He's also a person with amazing stories, and I was lucky enough to work on this project this 10-inch record for Sound American, Nate Woolley's project, with Joe, just basically interviewing him and getting him to tell those stories. So Joe is just, for me, he's an exceptional individual, and I think his music is also very particular, and it relates to a lot of other things, but it is very much its own. You know, he has this special place too, because he was living outside of New York. He was living in upstate New York, and during the era of loft jazz, I mean, he's a good example of how insular the loft jazz scene could be, that he was not invited to participate very often, or he didn't become part of that because he was from, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours away, which is kind of ludicrous, also given that he was willing to make the drive. But I think that scene was quite closed in a way that the New York scene that had led up to it was not as closed.
Yeah.
And so I see him as, and but what's good, what was good for him, even though it must have been exceedingly frustrating not to be included in that, is that pushed him another direction. So instead of sort of trying to become part of that scene or staying as a local musician in Poughkeepsie, he then went, you know, it forced him out of the fold, and he went to Europe, and he started making these relationships with people in Europe, and then people in Minneapolis, and people in other cities where otherwise it might have kind of retained this insular quality that I think some of that music stuck with.
It's so funny, Joe's because
super,
you...
super interesting guy. Sorry.
It's funny because what you're saying reminds me of something very similar happened in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, with the guys from Borbid Omegas, where they used to talk to me about, you know, they would come down from upstate New York and play shows and be regarded as these, like, backwoods hicks by the guys in the downtown scene. And so they wound up, you know, becoming a three-headed monster and doing their own thing for 30 years.
Yep. I think that's a great analogy. I think they're exactly, that's exactly right. And those guys... And the cool thing about being in a place like Nyack or Poughkeepsie is you're close enough that you know what's going on in that scene. You kind of know them, but they don't know you, which is an advantage in a way. And I think all of them work to that. You know, they could bring people up, and, you know, I actually played at Borbid Omegas invited me and a violinist that I was working with in 1987 up to play at their New Directions Festival in Nyack. And I got to play opposite Zena Parkins, who was like opening for Madonna from my standpoint. She was incredible, and got to play with Borbid Omegas, which was very exciting for an acoustic guitar player, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
but I mean, they had that same slightly outside feeling that allowed them to do something completely original, absolutely their own, just the way Joe did. And, you know, so Joe, you know, forged relationships with, like, Bill Smith, for instance, and Milo Fine, and André Jaume, and Raymond Bonny, and François Méchali. And he has had this really rich life of working with all of these and developing really intense histories with each of these different sets of people.
Yeah. You recently reissued, through Corbett First Dempsey, you recently reissued one of the all-time free jazz holy grails, which is Milford Graves' Baby.
That's true.
Had you been talking to him about that for a while? Tell me about that project, because when I saw the ad for it in The Wire, I was just like, holy shit, you know?
Yeah. It was a six-year process. Working, I've been friends with Milford for a long time, Been very lucky to learn from him over the course of about a 20-year period. And so about 6 years ago, he and I started talking seriously about that record and reissuing it and what it would mean for him to have more of his recorded legacy out in the world. And I've learned a lot of things over over a long period of reissuing records, and just now know that things take time, and that you can't, you know, this idea of trying to push things to happen in it right away is a kind of a stupid way of approaching them. And if someone comes along and scoops you, that's fine. There are other things to do. I kind of knew that wasn't going to happen here because we have a very trusting relationship, and we've worked on it already, and we've done a number of projects together. And so we have that record is out, and the next up is another Holy Grail, which is we're going to be putting out the complete Yale concerts. So the recordings that were made at Yale with Don Pullen and Milford Graves in 1965.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was the one that they put out themselves on vinyl with, like, the hand-painted covers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it came out. They were always self-issued, self-produced. The initial batch of them came out. It was two different records, although it was a little bit confusing because they were one of them was titled Nomo and one of them was titled The Yale Concert. And the first ones that they made on SRP Records were issued with, they didn't have enough money to make a printed cover, so they hand painted them. Hard to say how many, maybe 100 of them were hand painted. And then they came out with a cover, and then Nomo came out, and then Nomo was reissued again with a cover that had photographs of Milford, not from that period, but from later.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, it's some of the most incredible mid-60s music you'll ever hear. I mean, I think it's one of the most important records of all time. It's very different from Bobby. Bobby is an energy record. I mean, that's
yeah.
it's a heck of a record, and we put an additional CD's worth of never heard music on there by the same trio. The duets with Pullen are really exceptional for what Milford is introducing in terms of his approach to drumming. And if you think about it in relation to, like, the recording Mohawk, which is from a year earlier, which is also a very beautiful record that's not available on CD, it was very briefly issued on a tiny little Japanese reprint on CD, but is more or less impossible to find. But that record with New York Art Quartet, you hear him beginning to do this new thing, and in these you hear it open up completely.
Yeah.
And so I think this is, you know, the Yale concerts are where you hear the new concept as fully realized as anywhere else yet.
Yeah. Yeah. How does Corbett versus Dempsey work? I mean, it's an art gallery, it's a publisher, it's a record label. It seems to me like it must be like a really life-eating enterprise. Like, do you have to go to art fairs and stuff like that, or is that what your partner does, or, you know?
No, I do that too. You're quite right. That is it is a life-eating enterprise. Well, it is a life-sustaining enterprise too.
Mm-hmm.
So it, luckily, it's both of those. It's like life support and life suck.
but I mean, you also write and teach. So, like, when do you sleep?
Not as much as I'd like to. I've stopped teaching about 4 years ago. I quit my post at the School of the Art Institute because I found it very difficult moving back and forth between teaching and working at the gallery.
Mm.
And the interesting thing for me was I was writing on a sort of low simmer all that time. But I hadn't really worked on any bigger projects for quite some time in terms of from my writing about music standpoint. And when I quit teaching, it was like something uncorked. And suddenly there were these projects that I had put on a shelf for 20 years. I'm speaking of Microgroove, which was a book that I assembled out of many essays and interviews and articles that I'd written. But I had, you know, basically had it finished. I had a contract for it for 15 years. 20 years is when it had its first manifestation. And suddenly I found I could work on those things because I wasn't having to sort of shift back and forth between teaching and the gallery anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just get up every morning, and I developed a kind of a routine, a habit that I'd never had before, which is getting up in the morning, going to a cafe, and working for an hour and a half before work, and then going to work. And I had always been a deadline writer, so I would always put it off until the last minute, and then write it all the night before it was due, like it was a continuation of high school or college or something like that. And now I have a totally different way of working. Now my writing is something that I do with a much more relaxed pace and a much more relaxed attitude. So I wake up, I do what I need to do at home. I go try to get up earlier. I'm not going to sleep as late. So it's just shifted my entire thing. But now that's it. So, you know, you asked for detail. That's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I come from a background in, you know, regular journalism. Like, I worked at a local newspaper covering city council meetings and stuff. So, I mean, I've done that, and so I know how to write to deadline, and I know, you know, I mean, in 20-some years, I've never blown a deadline. You know, it's that repertorial discipline is tremendously helpful when it comes to criticism. I would say that is... There are two things that I think are tremendous, have shaped me as a writer more than anything else. And the first is actually working at a real newspaper. And the other was getting an audio engineering certification because it completely changed how I listen.
Wow.
And I can tell when I read someone else's writing that they have no idea how records are actually made.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But before this book, because you were saying you sort of, you know, turned on the faucet, and now there's been about four books in a few years. There was Microgroove, there was Vinyl Freak, and then you wrote, but the one before this one, I think, was A Listener's Guide to Free Improvisation, which is a really interesting idea for a book, and I'm curious about its audience, because the improv crowd is kind of self-selecting. You're sort of in or you're out, and you know right away whether it's for you. So how much demystification is actually going to get someone whose idea of a great guitarist is Angus Young to listen to Derek Bailey?
That's a great question. And that was exactly what I wanted to try to explore in writing the book. So I think it came from a feeling that I wanted to be sure that I wasn't constantly writing about the same music to the same people. That seems pretty futile to me. By the same token, I try not to predict my audience. Made a kind of a I'm not so interested in trying to presume or predict things about my audience. So I want to write about what I want to write about, and I try to draw them along, try to bring them in as best I can, but not do it based on whatever prejudices I have about who they are. Because I think one of the great things about writing is that you don't know who they are, and that they might well be very different from who you think they are. So if you follow demographics exclusively, you're going to miss out on one of the most important and exciting aspects of the process of writing. So that said, I set into it like thinking, I've written about this music for a long time, and I've written about it in ways that are aimed at people who have at least a cursory understanding of it and come at it from a historical standpoint and a kind of nerd standpoint. What if I wrote something that was much more open, based on years of teaching classes at the School of the Art Institute that were usually called sound improvisation, in which I was dealing with very creative people who didn't know anything about that history. And early on in that process, I realized that teaching them about that history was one thing, but it was different from trying to engage them in what's most interesting about that music. So if you try and bury it in like, well, you have to know about how, you know, Evan Parker's approach to the saxophone changed what was going on in European saxophone music in such and such a time, you were going to lose them right away. And more importantly, that's a different approach from the approach that might be the most fruitful, which is to put it out there as a more open-ended set of questions, set of proposals. So I just came up with this idea to write something, hopefully with a slightly different tone, open, loose, funny, a little bit self abnegating, that would try to take it away from being feeling like a music that was that thought too highly of itself.
Yeah.
And you know, most of the musicians I know who play freely improvised music listen to all sorts of different kinds of music. At least they listen to other kinds of jazz music, and almost all of them listen to music from all over the world, music from all sorts of genres, and they argue about it, and they have very steadfast opinions, and they're constantly trying to pick away at one another's pet loves. I think that, to me, that was, you know, I followed my cue from the fact that it's only a very small group of people who just are holed up in their closet listening to freely improvised music and nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, I joke about, you know, the people, what I call them is the people who spell improv with a capital I, you know, and they're mostly writers. The actual musicians are, you know, goofy dudes, you know, who will do what, who are down for whatever.
Yeah. You know, and who would love to argue with you about Aerosmith, for instance. And the great thing, you know, very exciting thing to me is that book has done very well. I mean, sort of certainly exceeded my editor's expectations.
Always nice.
And far exceeded, you know, I mean, it's done three times what they their initial press printing anticipated. So they've had to reprint it at least twice. And I haven't seen new numbers in 9 months, so I don't know how it's done. But it did really well considering what it was, that it was a modest little book and didn't get a ton of publicity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it did really well. So it was exciting. Of course you do something as audacious as make a book that purports to tell people how to listen to improvised music. And you know you're going to also draw the ire of a lot of other people, including people who play it.
Yeah.
So you know, it got all sorts of comments, but that's fine. It just puts out there a bunch of different things that I learned teaching improvised music, tries to put them into a palatable form.
Yeah.
Writing.
My last question is about something that I'm sure you're keenly aware of, you know, since you've been doing this since the 80s, which is the economic realities of a life in fringe culture.
Yes.
Like, most of the artists you champion through your reissue work and your writing don't make a ton of money from their music, and I can safely imagine, based on my own experience of 20 years as a music critic, that you're not a rich guy yourself.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you've seen anything, like whether it's the rise of Bandcamp or social media as a marketing platform, that seems like it's making an artist's life even slightly less precarious in the 21st century, or are things getting worse?
Well, I think a life in creative music is continues to be daunting in terms of its economics. I wouldn't generalize about it, because I think it changes. It's very different from context to context, and certain contexts seem to have ways in which you can leverage a little bit of what you do to make a little bit of money. If you're willing to travel and you have accumulated enough of a reputation, you can travel incessantly and make something of a living. But it's very, very, very difficult. I mean, I booked 10 years of concerts at the Empty Bottle, weekly series and an annual festival. And I didn't take any money when I did it, because there wasn't enough money to go around. I mean, I couldn't be taking money if the musicians were making so little. It's one of the things that shocks me about the scale difference between the art world, the visual art world, which I'm equally engaged in. Now I'm more engaged in than I am anything else, and the creative art, creative music world. The scale difference is just out of reality. I mean, the difference between what even a young artist might, how they might value their work relative to what a musician who's been around for 10 or 15 years might have to imagine they would get paid to do a gig. So a lot of the things just revolve back around how, what other kinds of ancillary work they're going to have to take, whether they're going to teach, whether they're going to, you know, what kinds of things they're going to do to make a living. And I don't really, you know, it saddens me that we don't have ways to reward people for doing the kinds of unusual cultural activities that don't draw huge audiences. But we have our meritocracy is entirely based on popularity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a particularly accurate register for what's valuable in the world of culture.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and part of the problem is that it's not always, it's part of the problem is this, it's not always immediately evident what is going to be long-term valuable. But what we're talking about is music that is immediate. So it's music that's being made right now, and people have to make a judgment about whether it has legs right now. And that's an impossible thing to know. You know, pick up the pieces. I'm looking back on music from decades ago, trying to figure out whether it's worth listening to now. And sometimes I'm still not sure. So, you know, it's a tricky business, but I think we need to have better, I wish we had better
ways of rewarding people for doing the kinds of risky activity that people are doing. And I just drove up to Detroit with Ken Vandermark the other day to do a book release event with him. He was kind enough to play with me while I was reading. And, you know, we spent 11 hours in the car sitting and talking, and not all of it in by any means about this, but some of it was talking about the day-to-day realities of doing what he does. And, you know, it's tough. It's very, very difficult. And I don't know that there's a good solution for it in a socioeconomic context like the one that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the European contexts in which there was an alternate system seem to be going the way of the United States now. So like the scene that existed in Holland for a long time, which supported one of the most extraordinary creative music scenes of all time, isn't functioning that way anymore. And the Swedish scene that created all sorts of great opportunities for Swedish musicians isn't functioning that way anymore. There's no support for traveling musicians there the way that there used to be, for instance. So it means that they're stuck. They're kind of stuck in their own Swedishness.
As
opposed to being forced out of it. So, mm-hmm. And we don't have anything like that. And one of the disadvantages and advantages of the American scene has been that there's no funding. There's mm-hmm. no funding at all. It's a disadvantage for obvious reasons, because that means there's no money. But it's advantageous because it means everybody has to learn how to work on their feet and has to really muscle through it and figure out alternate ways to do what they do. So I don't know. That's a long way of basically saying I don't think it's any better. From what I can tell, the only thing that's better about it is that communication is better. It's a little bit easier to communicate. When I was booking concerts and really deeply engaged in that as a day-to-day practice, the answering machine was the way that we communicated. And that was a massive pain in the ass. And I'm very glad that in the face of that, instead, we now have, you know, the internet.
Yeah.
And we have email, which is a much better way of time shifting, so that rather than having to come home and figure out if you can call somebody in Europe or Japan, you have to wait until X time and they've left you a message that's urgent and so on. That is much better. But that doesn't really help with the economics. It helps with the logistics. The economics seem to me, they're just still pretty fucking dire.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that was my interview with John Corbett, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon. It's just $5 a month, and your contributions will go a long way toward making Burning Ambulance better. More episodes, more content on the website, and my eternal gratitude. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and sign up, and I hope you'll come back for the next episode. Osiris.